My name's Matt. I'm the minister here at Maybridge. If we haven't met, you're extremely welcome. Also, if you are here for the first time or you're visiting, you are here on week one of a four-week series where we're talking about God and sex. So well done. Great time to start attending this church. I really want in these few weeks for it to not feel like school assemblies. Did anybody grow up with school assemblies? Chris Cronder, you used to be a head teacher. You must have been to a fair few school assemblies in your time. You know, where you sort of get kind of a do and don't moral sort of a message type thing. I don't want it to feel like that. When I was growing up, my dad was a vicar. He still is a vicar. My dad was a vicar. And I can remember at the age of 14, he would come into my school and do school assemblies, right? This used to be a thing. You're already laughing about this. Well, honestly, I did not look forward to it at the best of times. And then one day, my dad came to me and he said, Matt, next week in the school assembly, I'm coming in and I'm going to do the sex talk. And all my mates were going to be in the room. So I said to him, there's no need, because we all know what happens already. So you don't need to do it. Do the God loves everyone talk. That's brilliant, that one. That goes down really well. And he said, no, don't worry. Just trust me, this will be absolutely fine. And I should have pulled a sickie, obviously. So we get to the day. And obviously, I'm sat in the middle of the front row, of course. So I'm 14, my mates are there, about 200 other kids in my year. And my dad gets up, and his opening line, I'm not making this up, this is true. My dad's opening line, in front of all my mates, sex is amazing, I've done it over 1,000 times. It's the fact that he'd clearly done some arithmetic around it to get to that. Not cool. Anyway, let's talk about sex. Is that a more complicated and tricky personal thing to talk about in our culture? I don't think there is. Our society has no fixed view on healthy sexual expression. Is it in marriage? Is it just male, female? Is it okay with a group of people on your own? Should it be in a committed relationship? Is it okay to pay for it? Can a relationship be meaningful without it? Endless questions. But I want to sort of start by stepping back and asking, well, why is it that way? What has happened in our culture that makes sex such a big deal? Why is everybody so stressed and confused about it? We've been on a revolutionary cultural journey. Everything came to a head in the 1960s when a lot of practical things changed, the availability of contraception that just exploded, and it meant that people could have the possibility of sex without pregnancy, of course. But also in 1967, homosexuality was decriminalized in this country, meaning that same-sex relationships were out of the closet, so to speak. And these were just some of the outward developments. But those who are expert in these things say every culture tells us particular stories about who we are, what's important, what life should look like. And we know this happens intuitively in all sorts of ways. TV, news, internet conversations, and it chips away at our brains so much that over time, certain ideas, certain views are just assumed to be the right thing without any discussion. Well, what are some of the plot lines to our culture's story around sex? Well, let's look at a few of these. These are just the ones that I think are quite prominent. And I think this will help us to process what's going on, okay? So the first one, we're hooked on individualism in our culture, which means sex is for my pleasure. Sex is for my pleasure. Not just mine, but, you know, one's pleasure. It's fairly uncontroversial to say our society is very individualistic. But what does that mean? We have to be careful. A lot of the best bits of individualism are grounded in Christian thought. Each person has value and worth and freedom. But separated out of other good ideas, like community and mutuality, individualism ends up being something like, well, I'm the boss over everything. My morality, my identity, the whole thing, it's all defined by me. And this creates all manner of problems. If it's all about my own self-determination, my life, my preferences, then when it comes to sex, I'm under no obligation to commit to anybody beyond what feels best for me. If I like, I can pursue sexual experience for the sake of the experience itself, not the person. I may have a genuine affection for them. I may choose to be committed to them. I may even get married to them. But the point is, I don't have to. I live in a social framework where I can get out whatever I want out of it with very little consequence, apparently. Now, I may be glad that my partner enjoys sex too, but I don't have to be. In extreme individualism, sex becomes an activity with performers, not a union of givers. Secondly, romance is king, so sex is seemingly ultimate. In Western culture, over the last few centuries, we've tried to move God out of the picture, generally speaking. And so we've needed something else to replace him in our lives. Of course, people in all times and places have made something more important than God. But our culture has a particular philosophical underbelly, which means we idolize, we worship romantic intimacy, maybe more than anybody ever has. We look to romantic relationships to fulfill every single need. And it's not just out there, it's often us in the church too. Have you ever heard somebody speaking to somebody who happens to be single and they've said, "Oh, don't worry, God's got someone for you"? Oh, really? Is it impossible that God's will for that person is singleness? No. But we have this strange battle to conceive of somebody having a happy or meaningful life without a partner for some reason. In the ancient world, there are a lot of people who worship sexual experience. But there were also people who were respected for their celibacy. In our culture, celibacy is so off the radar, it doesn't compute. Many people don't just question, but simply cannot comprehend why somebody would not be as sexually active as possible. Are you mad? Go and get some. As the French postmodernist Michel Foucault observed, sex is treated as the master key to knowing who we are. Sex, the explanation for everything. Or as Andrew Sullivan writes, we live in a world in which respect and support for eros, or romantic love, has acquired the hallmarks of a cult. The worship of sex is so great, it's used to sell everything else. It's like, buy this yogurt and you'll definitely have more sex. We know the sex is what you really want, but our yogurt will help you get there. And that's the strategy. And of course, it works because we all want something transcendent in lives. We know sex promises that. So we go, yes, I will buy that yogurt. Then maybe on some level we're thinking I'll have more sex if I buy it. Personally, I prefer a Müller rice, but don't read anything into that. Third thing, physical reality is all there is, so sex is just an appetite. The assumption of materialism, that everything is just sort of here by accident, there's no God, no afterlife, no reality behind what your senses can sense, this assumption right now is enormous. There are signs it's changing, but it's huge. And so this is a bit of a paradox. On the one hand, people want sex because it makes them feel good. On the other hand, our materialism says, well, we're just animals who happen to have larger brains and sex is it's meaningless. It means nothing. So you might as well have as much as you like because at the end of the day, it has the same profound value as washing your car. So it doesn't matter. It's all about sating a biological appetite and maybe reproducing. And if you have a good time on the way there, great. This view means pornography, multiple partners, sex outside commitment, it's all fine because it's all just an appetite. It's not sacred. No guilt for anything, no strings attached. It's all meaningless, apparently. Fourth thing, we're suspicious of traditional authority, so sex is not limited by traditional boundaries. While in the past, as a culture, we've tended to trust people in positions of authority, we now automatically distrust politicians, church leaders, etc., etc. We see that they're no better than us morally, that's true. And whereas decades ago, people in these positions would likely be more educated than everybody else, that's not true anymore. So why would you trust anybody in these positions? Why not just trust your own instincts? And because we don't trust traditional authority, we don't need to worry about traditional boundaries around sex. Get free from the shackles, or put them on if that's what you prefer. So the historical position of the church, for many people, feels very constrictive and conservative and dull. We may suspect that the church's position on these things is based on some historical stuff that doesn't apply now. You know, the Bible's really old anyway, isn't it? It's all a constraint on our great freedoms. And maybe as church, we don't articulate what we think about this very well either. But this belief promises we can be free of the old barriers, go and enjoy sex with whoever, whenever, don't worry about it, just go and enjoy yourself. And so given that the choice feels like, it's not that it is, but it feels like, well, either miserable abstinence based on a dusty old book, or have all the sex that you want with whoever you want, with no strings attached, guess which of those two is winning in people's minds? Now, this is all interesting stuff, at least I think so. But unless you're reading up on sociology or philosophy, this is not what we come across every day, is it? What we come across every day is story. It's a Hollywood movie where the two lead characters overcome every obstacle because their romantic love for each other trounces everything else. Everything else is less important. It's a TV documentary about a teenager struggling with their sexuality, and they come out to their parents and there's all the emotions around it and the discussion. It's the magazine in the doctor's waiting room with a story about the woman who left her terrible partner, lost 10 pounds, and now apparently has life-changing sex 3 times a day with her new man. Now, none of these are all bad in themselves, in a way, and none of the values behind them are all bad. But when ideas are transmitted by stories, and when these stories are told again and again, we buy into them hook, line, and sinker without knowing that it happened and without thinking about what we're really taking on. We like to believe that we're all very clear-minded and rational, but in reality, it's the emotional power of story that shapes a lot of what we think, and particularly about sex. When I began speaking today, I told you a story. It was a true story, but why did I tell you? Lots of communicators do the same thing. Well, the short answer is it warms people up and makes you more relatable. Well, why does that matter? Well, because telling you a story where you feel for me with my 14-year-old situation makes you trust me more, makes you sympathize with me. It makes you have my ear. Well, why do I want that? Well, so that you take on what I'm saying and from my point of view, hopefully buy into it. That's what happens all of the time with all the stories we come across. Story has the power to change our values and beliefs through the back door without us having any idea what happened. When it comes to sex, the story is everywhere. But there's a story behind the story. Sex is, I think, a search for intimacy and transcendence. It's a search for intimacy and transcendence. That's what everybody really wants. That's why people want sex. To find real closeness with somebody and yet have your mind blown at the same time. To be completely known and yet somehow overwhelmed simultaneously. As Christians, we might say, everybody is perhaps unknowingly seeking the joy and the closeness to one day be found fully in God. So we're very influenced by story. But maybe even more significant than the stories we tell are the stories that we dwell. What we say is one thing, but what is actually happening? The stories our culture tells us around sex are very appealing, but we should ask, is it working? In real everyday life, how does this play out? All this permission, apparently, and emphasis and encouragement to have consequence-free sex with whoever, whenever, forever, sounds great, sounds like freedom. What's the fruit of thinking this way? If the sexual revolution began in the 60s, we're over 50 years in, I think we can ask, how's it going? And strip away the headlines and the tweets, and let's look at some of the naked statistics, puns intended. These are really interesting. According to an Ipsos poll in 2018, and this was a survey of men, men guessed that British men aged 18 to 29 have sex 180 times a year. So basically every couple of days. The reality, having surveyed thousands of people, is 50. Bit of a difference. Men guessed that British women aged 18 to 29 have sex 22 times a month. Reality, 5 times. The British National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles. In general, we are having sex at any age, on average, 2 to 3 times a week, when in previous decades, it was 5. That's a lot less. We are having less sex as a culture than we used to, by a long way. According to Public Health England in 2018, half of women aged 25 to 34 don't enjoy sex at all. Half. Women at the prime of their lives. You don't see this on TV, do you? A few more. The Observer Sex Survey, completed in 2014, said that the national libido is in decline. Sexual satisfaction is in decline. Over just 6 years, the number of people who rated themselves as good at sex, whatever that means, dropped from 55% to 33%, a 22% drop in confidence around sex. The average number of sexual partners a person has in a lifetime has gone up. The average is now 6 to 10, with the mean being 9.5. And yes, I know you can't have sex with half a person, right? Statistics. But Nicholas Wolfinger, who is a sociologist from the Institute of Family Studies, says this. The evidence suggests the more sexual partners you've had, the less satisfying you find sex to be. Don't hear that in the newspapers either, do you? The more sexual partners you've had, in general, the less satisfying you find sex to be. Bit on porn usage. Porn generates more money than Google, Apple, Amazon, eBay, Yahoo, and Netflix combined. That's quite a lot of money, I think. 13% of the entire internet, at least, is porn. And I think it's something like 24% of what's downloaded. Think about all the stuff that humans discuss or talk about, and yet with all the stuff that there is, at least an eighth of the total sum of everything that is online is porn. The most popular day of the week for watching porn is Sunday, because it's also the loneliest day of the week, statistically. If there's only something else you could do on a Sunday to have all your relational needs met, eh? Also, interestingly and tragically, more than 50% of those seeking sexual interaction online claim to have diminished desire for real sex. That's not surprising. This is, interestingly, a third of the partners of those people claim the same. In other words, if your partner is looking to the internet to have their sexual needs met, your own sexual desire notably diminishes. Interesting. What does all this tell us? 50 years into this sexual revolution thing, as a culture, we're watching other people have sex and paying a fortune to do it while desiring our real life partners less. We're having less sex. We're having less enjoyable sex. Meanwhile, we somehow think that everybody else is having better and more sex than they actually are. It's going really well, isn't it? Let me put it to you, before we even get to Christian specifics, the approach to sex our culture has developed isn't working. It's wrong. If we're serious about sex, we're doing it wrong. We need a new position. Pun intended. The stories we have dwelt do not add up. All the glamour magazines and the websites and the films and social media are lying. They're lying. They tell us everybody else is out there having amazing consequence-free sex every 10 minutes and taking in porn and there's no problems and it's all possible because we're all liberated and free. Nonsense. Absolute rubbish. The research says as much. The reality is closer to the opposite. And so for all the bits in our culture that have changed in the last 50 years and many good things, overall we've lost our way on something. Something does not add up. And so I'd like us to look at the Bible and some of what it says about sex. Clearly we can only scratch the surface in this little series, because consider this. Half the New Testament letters talk about sex. Jesus talks about it, appears in the Old Testament a whole bunch of times. There's a whole book about it in the Old Testament called Song of Songs. But I want to focus today on a couple of passages that I think can help orientate us. But they're not random. I want us to grasp that God has a better story for us to dwell and to tell than our story does. And I think these passages move us towards that story. The first one is in Genesis 1. Really early in the Bible, goes like this from verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." than in Genesis 2. The Lord said, "It's not good for the man to be alone. I'll make him a helper suitable for him." Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them, and whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the man gave names to all the livestock, the birds in the sky, and all the wild animals. But for Adam, no suitable helper was found. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep, and while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and then closed up the place with flesh. Then the Lord made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. The man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. So this is really two passages, but one event. They tell the same story, and both tellings are useful today. Sexuality begins to be understood, biblically at least, by the idea in 1 verse 26. Let us make mankind in our own image. It's plural. It's the Trinitarian God saying, all of me is invested in this. And what I'm going to create here is somehow in my likeness, in a way that the other created stuff is not. And he makes male and female. And you might have noticed there's an emphasis in both passages on the man and woman stewarding and ruling over everything together. Now think about this. If the man and the woman steward over everything together, the dynamics of that relationship, how they are with one another, will have an enormous effect on everything else. All of creation, their own children, everything. They are to reflect the nature and character of God himself. Just as God is one and yet three persons mysteriously, he's the same but different within himself. He's all about the relentless self-giving and the joy of the other members of that Trinity. And in the same way, man and woman are supposed to be the same when they are joined together. This sets the tone for sex. It's supposed to reflect the nature of God himself. And this does two things. Firstly, it challenges us because sex has a context. It says man and woman leaving father and mother, united with one another, married in other words. And it's not just for them. It's a picture for everybody of the God who created it. And in this created order, what happened? Immediately, Adam and Eve were naked and felt no shame. They were fully themselves, fully visible to the other, everything on show, literally. And there were no questions about acceptance or demands about performance, just a space for real, genuine intimacy. Secondly, it reassures us because sex is not ultimate. It's appointed to something else. It's not meant to be the focus of human experience. As soon as we load it with that, we put a pressure on it that it was never meant to take. The romantic ideal of another person who completes everything for us as we enjoy moments of sexual bliss every 5 minutes is a Disneyfied dream that does not exist in real life. What's wonderful about this is that even here, right from the moment of creation, the beginning point of sexual union, the good news is tantalized. The news that humans can be united to God himself. That's the story of the whole Bible, and the hints are already here. And it's wonderful because if sex is just the picture, the shadow, the reality must be even better. God must see humans have the best sex possible and say, whoa, you think that's good? The intimacy and the pleasure you have right now, just you wait. As the author Jonathan Grant writes in his excellent book, Divine Sex, our experience of romantic love, sexual desire, and all forms of beauty is a testimony to our ultimate desire for God. In these moments, we experience a sort of momentarily redeemed nature where we feel what we were created to experience, ecstatic intimacy with God and others. In essence, we taste our origins and our future destiny. Sexual intimacy within marriage, then, is a visible sacrament that participates in and reveals the unseen God. When we naively make sex a simple appetite like eating a meal, or a physical act like playing squash, or even sadly a transaction like going to the shops, it's devalued for everybody. And every time we do it, we diminish the image of God in our minds because we train ourselves to think of the sacred as trivial. The best sex, self-giving, caring, creative, and yet in a place of safety, is just like the God who invented it. And it's a taster of what our eternal relationship with him will be like. It's worth protecting and pursuing and praying for. Second passage to look at. 1 Corinthians 6 in the New Testament, written to a church. And it says this, just in the middle of the letter. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. You say, food for the stomach and a stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh. But whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you've received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honour God with your bodies. When this was written, the city of Corinth, who received this, this is where this letter was received, was so famous for sexual promiscuity that if you slept around a lot in that in the ancient world, you got called acting like a Corinthian. That's what was going on in Corinth. But it's amazing to compare how much there is to today. Everyone seems to think that in biblical times, everybody was really naive about sex. It could not be further from the truth. Now, we have to be careful. This letter was written to Christians. It's not calling people who are not part of church to any particular standard. But we can and should use many issues, including sex, as bridges to talk about how what God says is better than what everything else that is offered. And it starts with Paul quoting or sort of rehearsing the sort of things the Corinthians would say. And remember, it's Christians he's writing to. It's Christians that thought this. I have the right to do anything. Is that not absolutely the same as our culture? I can do what I like. I don't need somebody coming and telling me different. Paul's reply is wonderful. Okay, but not everything is beneficial. I will not be mastered by anything. They're saying, well, Paul, you know, we can do whatever we like. We're allowed to do whatever we want. And he's replying, well, fine, yeah, you can. But why not think about actually whether it's any good? You can do what you want. Why not think about whether it's a good thing? And it's like earlier when we said, you know, we asked about what our culture's approach to sex is and whether it even works. And people also said things like, food for the stomach and a stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. And that was an old saying, and that basically meant, well, you might as well do what you like, because what happens in this life doesn't matter. This is all there is, doesn't matter. And it's a bit like the materialism of our culture, but for different reasons. It's saying that what happens in this world isn't a big deal. There's nothing transcendent or sacred or special. And Paul pushes back. And remember, this is not just a moral guide to sex. It's a call to understand the specialness of the human body before God. It's a higher, more meaningful view of the body and therefore of sex. And he says several astonishing things here, right? Firstly, the body has value, not just sexually, but before God. Lots of people thought then, as they do now, that the body's just a container for your mind or your soul. It's low, it's base. Doesn't matter, you know, you're just a sack of flesh. But Paul says, no, because of the way God made you, your body and what you do with it matter. You're so much more valuable than you realize. Your body is a member of Christ. It's part of God's community on earth. It's staggeringly valuable. You might look at yourself in the mirror and go, well, I'm not really sure about that. But God says it's true, so it is. You were fearfully and wonderfully made, like it or not. Secondly, he says, don't sell yourself off. There's a warning against sexual immorality, and it sounds quite negative. The word he uses here is porneion, which is where we get the word pornography from. But it derives from the word perneo, which means selling off or surrendering. That's not an accidental word. Paul's saying, when you use sex in a way that's not God's, you're selling yourself off. and you're getting the other person who's involved to do the same. That's not being negative. It's a warning about messing up a positive. It's only because your body and how you use it for intimacy matters that this selling off is a danger. It's the highest view of sex there can be, actually. Our culture says, have sex with whoever, it doesn't matter, no consequence. But it unites you with somebody to a level where actually we don't even have a choice. The science bears this out, in fact. The researcher Nancy Piercy talks about the effect of the hormone oxytocin on women, which for years was associated only with child rearing. It's been called the attachment hormone. But it's been quite recently discovered that it's also released during sex. And she writes, the desire to attach to the other person when we have sex is not only an emotion, but also part of our chemistry. When we have intercourse, we create an involuntary chemical commitment. Even if you think you are having a no-strings-attached hookup, you are in reality creating a chemical bond. For men, it's not much different. The main neurochemical responsible for male response in sexual contact is vasopressin. Scientists believe it stimulates bonding with a woman and with her offspring. Vasopressin has been dubbed the monogamy molecule. In other words, these things that happen to us biologically during sex, which we have no control over, bond us to the other person. Like it or not. Psychiatrist and author Miriam Grossman comments on this. You might say, we are designed to bond. In light of our biology, it's only common sense to say we should be careful who we let our brains become attached to. In fact, a 2005 study of young women found that those who had multiple sexual partners were 11 times more likely than women who had never had sex at all to experience elevated depressive symptoms. Isn't that staggering? In other words, the research says it's not a lack of sex that messes up anybody's mental health. It's having sex outside its intention that is far more problematic. I know we're rattling through here, but third thing, Paul says, you're not your own. These words sound very controlling, don't they? They sound like echoes of the sort of institutions and people we've learned not to trust. But wait, the reason you are not your own is beautiful. You were bought. Jesus purchased you on the cross. You personally. The whole perspective of this, the whole biblical posture on sexuality is based on the fact that Jesus literally gave his own self, his own body, to purchase us. And so he has claim to us. It's another of those things that's both reassuring and comfortable at the same time. Uncomfortable, I should say. It's why Paul can say, flee from sexual immorality, you were bought at a price. It's actually the one who purchased you, insisting through Paul's words. You're not your own. And that's good. Someone thought you were cosmically valuable, aside from what you could give them sexually. Wow. Fourthly, by implication, sex is sacred. Now, this goes very against the popular idea of sex right now, that you can have meaningless sex with no consequence. But it's true. And I think that we know that it is. Think about it like this. In recent years, you're probably familiar with what's become known as the Me Too movement. People know the Me Too movement. And it's been around terrible stories of mainly women who've been mistreated sexually. And sadly, there's been thousands of stories to tell, and it's become this whole thing. But probably the most infamous villain of the Me Too thing has been the Hollywood film producer Harvey Weinstein, using an example that probably has no connection to any of us. And Harvey Weinstein, he was an incredibly rich and successful man. And he's now in prison because he used his power and influence to extort young actresses into doing sexual things for him with the promise of giving parts in his films. Absolutely terrible, disgusting thing. But it's an illustration of how we know sex is sacred. If Harvey Weinstein had simply extorted money off all these young women, everybody would say, well, that's bad. He should be in trouble for that. But because it was sexual, we're outraged, and rightly so. We know that it's worse than if it was just money, don't we? We know that exploiting the human body intimately is somehow worse than exploiting somebody for cash. But that can only be true if the body is valuable, more valuable than money. And intuitively, we know that it is. And that means what we do sexually and what's done to us matters hugely. We can't get away from it. And this means that the church's 2,000-year-old view on sex is far, far, far from outdated. Nancy Piercy again writes this. I think I pressed the wrong button like I did at breakfast church. Thanks, Bruce. Nancy Piercy again writes this. Critics say the church should change its sexual morality or be left behind, or that terrible phrase, the wrong side of history. History proves the opposite. The sexual ethic of the church is one reason it grew in the early centuries, especially among women. In Roman society, free men married so they would obtain legal heirs, but it was normal that they found sexual satisfaction with girlfriends, mistresses, slaves, and whoever else they wanted. There were virtually no limits on sexual behaviour as long as you did it in moderation. But Christianity was radical because it channeled male sexual desire into monogamy. In effect, Christianity elevated the status of women and protected everybody from being treated as fair game by saying to the men, you commit to your wife and nobody else. Doesn't feel so outdated, does it, when we think about it in this way? It was shocking at the time, but it worked a revolution that civilized the world sexually. Now, you might be here today thinking, you know what, this is all well and good. Maybe there's a pattern and a path for sex that reflects God's ways, but I know I've not been on that path. You don't know what I've done or maybe even what's been done to me. God may say that I'm valuable in myself, but I've cheapened myself or someone has done that to me. I wouldn't want to undermine any of that, but I just want to share this verse. This is Hebrews 4 from verse 15. About how Jesus enters into our real life experience. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Because Jesus walked among us, he experienced all the stuff we do, including sexual temptation and mistreatment by others. He knows what it's like. But also, this is incredible. Because of the cross, we get to swap our sexual history with Jesus. He gets our lust, our selfish extramarital sex, our affairs, our abuse, our porn addictions. We get his sexual history. Self-sacrifice, purity, treating every other person as a human, not an object, perfect sexual integrity. All that is transferred to us in the sight of God. It's not just abstract theology. This is what the living God does for us. So whatever you have done, whatever has been done to you, with Jesus, you are forever clean in the eyes of God, and you can be clean again and again and again every day in this life with him. Really, is that good news? So as we bring this into land, I know I've talked for a long time today. As we bring this into land, what have we said? Just some bullet points. What our culture presently tells us about sex is confusing, distorted, and demonstrably does not work. God has made us for intimacy in a way that reflects his nature. Sex is sacred and is a picture of the ultimate intimacy, an idea which frees and dignifies us. God intended sex for marriage because each of us is valuable and what we do with our bodies matters. Jesus purchased us, and God's don'ts around sex point positively to its specialness. And in Jesus, God cleans up our sexual histories so we can all be pure before him. After all this, what's the message? What do we have to say to our broken world about sex? The thing is, there's not really a way of saying this in a vacuum. And when you express it in bullet points, it's not quite so engaging, is it? I've thought about this a bit, and I've imagined a situation, just for me personally, where my kids have grown up a bit, and they're all teenagers. And they come to me and they say, Dad, what do Christians think about sex? It's all a bit old-fashioned, isn't it? And I hope I can tell a better story than what they'll hear elsewhere. And I think it would go like this. I'm just going to read to you what I want to say to them when they're teenagers. Now, if it helps you, close your eyes. It's not a prayer, but it might just be something that is helpful for you to hear as well. So I'm just going to read this and then hand back to Phil. This is what I'd say to them. The world tells us all sorts of stories about our worth and where we'll find joy and satisfaction. They're all onto something, but they fall just short. All the research tells us as much, actually. Sex was invented by God, and the key thing about it is it's a picture of the relationship he wants with us, and one day it will happen in full. But we somehow trivialize the transcendent. Our culture tells us the Christian view of sex is limiting. I think we dare to say our culture's view of sex is limiting and perhaps even naive. But God's story is wonderful. He says our sexual desires and hope for intimacy are signposts to what we can have with him forever. He loves you more than any man or woman ever could, and he wants a connection with you not found elsewhere. If you do have sex one day, I hope you get to enjoy it in the way God intended. I hope you find it brings joy and closeness in a safe space with someone committed to you as a marriage partner. But I don't want you to look for all the answers in the romantic ideal of movies and magazines. It's just not real. You might find in life you're attracted to people of the same sex, or to people who would treat you badly, or to someone who rejects you. Or it might be that you aren't attracted to anybody. All of these could be a struggle for you in different ways. Equally, you might find a fantastic partner who you love, but find sex itself to be difficult. The best way to navigate this is to see sex not as the goal, but as one of the best signposts to it. You really are valuable, and what do you do with yourself matters so much. The better story, the best story, is that even the best sex, even in a healthy marriage as God intended, is just a glimpse, a taste of our eternal relationship with him, something that any of us can have. And he came to purchase us for just that. Hold on to it.